Okay, we have come to lesson 10, which is Daniel chapter 9. And we'll tell you that we're going to have to move pretty quickly tonight. So kind of declutter your brain right now and just buckle up and get ready for kind of a swift ride. Because there's a lot to cover. You might say, well, the vision itself is only four verses. Well, those four verses are chopped about as full as four verses can possibly be. And we will spend the bulk of our time talking about those. But just kind of sort of giving us some headings for this chapter, just to sort of orient us to what's being said. First of all, we have Daniel's prayer, which is obviously a vital part of the place in this chapter. And certainly this prayer involves a confession of sin on the part of Daniel and his people. You have a plea, of course, for mercy and forgiveness for those people. And then you also have a plea for the city of Jerusalem and for God's sanctuary. Now, what do we mean by the sanctuary? What do the scriptures mean by the sanctuary? The temple. We'll talk some more about the emphasis upon that in Daniel's prayer in just a minute. And then, of course, you have the vision of 70 weeks. Now, I'll tell you that we're not going to give as much time to this prayer as it deserves because there's so much in this vision that we need to talk about. But I do want us, before we go any further, I want us to just say a word or two about the man. When we get caught up in the vision and all those details there, I want us to talk a little bit about him, about his character, what is revealed about his character here in this chapter. And this will, of course, add to what we've already seen previously in the book. Let's look there in chapter 9 and verse 2. In the first year of his reign, I, Daniel, understood by the books the number of the years specified by the word of the Lord through Jeremiah the prophet, that he would accomplish 70 years in the desolations of Jerusalem. Well, what does this tell us that Daniel has been doing? He's been reading.
Searching.
Yeah, he's been searching the scriptures. We've already seen, and we'll talk some more about this prayer in just a moment, or at least God's response to the prayer, but we've already seen him to be a praying man. But he's also a reading man. He's been reading the scriptures. And I thought it was important that we sort of emphasize that. Now, as far as this 70 years that Jeremiah had predicted, for this captivity in Babylon, two passages specify that. This is where we would see that reference to the 70 years. And of course, as this chapter opens, we're very near to the end of those 70 years, and Daniel knows that. And one of the things, you know, somebody might say is, well, if God has already promised this, then why the need to pray? I guess somebody might reason their way out and say, well, God's already said he's going to do it. But that doesn't stop him from still pleading with the Lord to fulfill this promise, to bring this mercy upon his people. All right, now let's read verses 20 through 23. I'll get someone else to read that if you don't mind.
While I was speaking and praying, confessing my sin and the sin of my people in Israel, and making my plea before the Lord my God for the holy hill of my God, while I was speaking in prayer, the man Gabriel, whom I had seen in the vision at first, came to me in swift flight at the time of the evening sacrifice. He made me understand, speaking with me and saying, O Daniel, I have now come out to give you insight and understanding. At the beginning of your pleas for mercy, a word went out, and I have come to tell it to you, for you are greatly loved. Therefore, consider the word and understand it.
Pretty good stuff, right? First of all, let's make sure we understand power of what's said in verse 23 at the beginning of it. given to Daniel, this response that God gives to Daniel's prayer is given to him because he is what?
Highly esteemed.
Highly esteemed, or greatly beloved, or greatly loved, depending on the translation that you're reading. Well, I guess the question would be, is that the kind of relationship that each one of us has with God? Would he refer to us in this manner? We are greatly beloved. I tell you what, if that is the case, we're in a pretty good position, aren't we? We can pray and certainly be extremely confident in God's response to that. And so, again, that tells us a lot about his character, how he is viewed especially in the eyes of God. Okay, a little bit more on Daniel's prayer here at the beginning, or at least in the first, 19 verses of this chapter. Throughout Daniel's prayer, the city of Jerusalem is very much on his mind. That's important because I believe that sets the stage for what is revealed in the vision in the last four verses of this chapter. You see that in verses 7, 16, 18, and 19. And I want you to notice especially the use of the word desolate or desolations when used to describe the condition of the city and the temple. We just read from chapter 9 and verse 2, which spoke of the desolations of Jerusalem. Now look at verses 17 and 18. Now, therefore, our God, hear the prayer of your servant, his supplications, and for the Lord's sake, cause your face to shine on your sanctuary, which is desolate. O my God, incline your ear and hear. Open your eyes and see our desolations, the city which is called by your name. For we do not present our supplications before you because of our righteous deeds, but because of your great say that because when we get to the discussion about the vision, we're going to see this word and other forms of this word used again. And we're going to see in just a minute Jesus even making reference to the desolation of Jerusalem. This vision reveals to Daniel some news about Jerusalem and its future. Now, that's not what it's all about, but that's at least a big part of it. It tells Daniel about what's going to happen to Jerusalem and the temple in the future. So here's the question. Is it good news or is it bad news? It's good news. Is it all good news? Break it down, what the vision reveals is simply this. It will be restored and rebuilt. Of course, we know that that happened. We read about that in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah and so forth. It will be restored and rebuilt, but one day it will be brought to a full end, or it will be made desolate. In other words, it's going to be restored and rebuilt, but then it's going to be destroyed. Okay? That's really the simplest message in the vision. Some good news for the more immediate future. But looking on down the road, you see, of course, the bad news for Jerusalem. Did Jesus speak of this coming destruction upon Jerusalem? Absolutely.
Matthew chapter 24,
you have very detailed information given there.
You have the parallel account there in Mark chapter 13.
Of course, you know, the accounts read a little bit differently. There's some more details in one than the other.
And then you have quite a bit of detail in Luke chapter 17 and 21.
So Jesus spoke pretty extensively about a coming destruction upon Jerusalem.
This took place in AD 70, when the Roman army, led by a general named Titus, destroyed Jerusalem and the temple. Now, what's interesting is in Matthew 24, in verse 15, it says, "Therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation," notice now, "spoken of by Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains."
Jesus is talking specifically in this passage about this coming destruction of Jerusalem. He makes reference back to things that Daniel said concerning this.
Now, this exact phrase, "abomination of desolation," is not used here in chapter 9.
It will be used later in the book of Daniel. But you see phrases very similar to it here in chapter 9. Now, that's the reason why I said to pay close attention to the use of that word desolation. Or to see Jesus use it in reference to the destruction of Jerusalem.
Okay.
The vision tells of 70 weeks. 70 weeks.
Does each week represent a year,
and so 490 years. That is a very popular belief in the minds of many. Is that so? No. Anybody got a yes? If this is so, what would we have to do to come to that conclusion? I'd say we'd have to guess, wouldn't we? Come to that conclusion, we have to guess.
Because God didn't tell us.
If this is so, God didn't tell us that in this vision, each week represents a year. It tells us.
Now, what's significant about that is, He did tell us in Numbers 14:34, and also in Ezekiel 4, verses 4 through 6.
The Numbers 14 passage talks about them having to suffer in the wilderness a year for each day they spied out the land. They spied out the land for 40 days. So He says, all right, you're going to be punished out in the wilderness then for 40 years. So He tells us there what each day would represent.
In Ezekiel 4, verses 4 through 6, you have that period of time that Israel was to lie on his side. Remember, one time for 390 days, another 40 days.
He said, well, that represents the number of years of Israel's iniquity. And so in these two passages, there's no confusion. The days represent years.
Well, we don't have anything like that here.
And so, again, it just becomes mere speculation to make that the case.
Many will use an exact chronology.
They use this figure 490 years.
And they'll start with 445 B.C. when Artaxerxes issued the command for Nehemiah to return and rebuild the walls.
Remember the story there, Nehemiah? You know, people come and they tell him, you know, about the walls and everything's in disarray and everything. And he goes and makes a request to the king. Please let me go back for a period of time and have to take charge of this situation. And Artaxerxes issues a for him to go and to get the supplies that he needs and so forth.
Okay. Only problem with that is Isaiah 44, verses 26 through 28, and 45, 1 through 13, tell us that Cyrus
would issue the command.
And using Ezra 1, 1 through 4, which talks about the decree of Cyrus, allowing him to return to the land and so forth, that would be about 538 or 537 B.C.
Because that first return was in Pilate for the 60s. So, I'm not sure how they could start before 45 B.C. with the command of Artaxerxes, when it's made clear that it would be by Cyrus that this would be issued. Now, if we start with 538, and we go 490 years, do you see a problem there? That doesn't even bring us up to what? It doesn't even bring us up to the birth of Jesus, does it? Is Jesus discussed in this vision? Speaks of the Messiah, doesn't it? The things the Messiah would accomplish in his reign, and how the Messiah would be cut off, and so forth. But if we start with this state, we don't even get to the birth of Jesus. So there's a problem in using the exact chronology there. And I'll say there's a whole lot more that could be said about this, but even those who use 445 B.C. have to insert mysterious gaps. In other words, those who use this date, they know that it doesn't all add up, and so they'll put these gaps of time between certain of the weeks, and they'll allow for certain things to happen during that time. You know, like the, we'll get into that a little bit later. But anyway, if you look at some of these breakdowns, you'll see that it's just a mess. There's just no way that I can see, at least, to, you know, use the 490 years and have this come out exactly like it ought to come out. So I don't believe what the Lord intends for us here is to use each week as a year and count down exactly 490 years. I just don't believe that is the case at all. All right, so let's discuss an alternative. What's the significance of the number 7? Seven people. Completeness. Fullness. Yeah. I think there's ample evidence of that throughout Scripture. Genesis 4:15. Whoever kills Cain, vengeance shall be taken on him sevenfold. So exactly sevenfold, right? Whatever he did to Cain, we're going to do that to you exactly seven times. What's the idea behind that? Full or complete vengeance will be exercised. Numbers 11, 16 through 30, kind of interesting, that 70 elders chosen to represent the people. I'm not sure if I understand the full significance of that, but that would kind of make for a full compliment, wouldn't it? And then in Ezekiel 8, verse 11, you have these 70 elders kind of introduced to us again. This time it's talking about judgment coming upon them, and what the whole point of that passage is to symbolize the full or the complete corruption of the nation. Look what has become of these elders. Look what has become of all the leaders. God's judgment coming upon them. Zechariah 3:9, together with Zechariah 4, verse 10, talks about the seven eyes of God. God's got seven eyes. Then you have a body, God is a spirit. What would be the significance behind seven eyes? See it all. The full, complete vision of everything that is going on, right? Matthew 18, verse 21. We're taught to forgive 70 times 7. Full and complete forgiveness. Not a precise measurement of how many times. The book of Revelation, you have seven churches, seven lampstands, seven horns, seven eyes, seven seals, seven trumpets, seven bowls, seven blades. Again, I don't think it's too hard to read through the book of Revelation to see that. It makes the difference there. So, I believe there is evidence in the text itself to support this idea behind the 7 weeks. For example, they're picking up with the latter half of verse 26. It talks about the people of the prince who is to come shall destroy the city and the sanctuary. The end of it shall be with a flood. Until the end of the war, desolations are determined. The very last phrase there in verse 27. Even until the consummation, or to the full end, which is determined, is poured out on the vessel. So one of the features of this vision is the full, the complete end that is going to be brought upon Jerusalem and upon the temple. So again, I believe there's evidence in the text itself suggests that this is really the much better approach. Now, there may be something to the fact early in the chapter, it is determined, I still think there's a figurative use of it here. But how many years had Daniel been reading about the desolations which would come upon Jerusalem according to Jeremiah? How many years was it? 7 years. All right, so in the vision, he speaks of the 70 weeks and all of these things would take place. Okay, so let's get to the vision itself. There in chapter 9, verses 24 through 27. Verse 24, I think it's pretty apparent, is more of a general statement or an overview, outlining the things that will take place during the 70-week period. But then as we get into verses 25 through 27, it's more detailed, at least in terms of breaking the weeks down into segments. You see that? Verse 24 talks about the whole period of 70 weeks. Verses 25 through 27 breaks it down into segments. It talks about what will take place during each segment. That's kind of the way the passage is set up. Alright, so let's talk about the overview there in verse 24. First of all, we know that something is determined or decreed for your people and for your holy city. There will be more detail about that in the following verses, so just to kind of jump ahead just for a second, we've already talked about this a little bit. It's going to be restored or rebuilt, but then what? Restored. Right. But here in verse 24, it's just kind of a general statement. Something is determined or decreed for the city. And then you have three things mentioned. We'll finish or restrain the transgression. Most of the language experts say that restrain is the idea of the word used there. To make an end of sins, or end of sin. Some translations carry with the idea of sealing it up. And then to make reconciliation for iniquity. Or to make atonement for iniquity. Or to forgive iniquity. Is the way it's rendered in some other translations. Well, I'll tell you. I don't know that I know how to make a distinction between all three of those. It's kind of difficult to say for sure exactly what each one of those phrases mean and make a distinction between them. Here's what Brother Walden said concerning this. You can evaluate this. He says, it seems best to me for the first expression to mean put away apostasy and rebellion. Attitude that characterizes the disobedient. The second expression would mean to make an end of the practice of sin. And the third, to remove the guilt of sin. Now, he is careful to say that he does not know for sure if that's really what is conveyed in those three different expressions. Having said that, though, I will say that these three are all, or were all, objective. Our Jesus Christ in coming to this world. He has to forgive us of our wrongs, but to also turn our rebellious hearts back to God. And then for us to live a lifestyle of righteousness, not of sin, to turn away from sin, be zealous for every good work. And so, I don't know again if that's what's conveyed here, but I do believe all of those principles are very clearly taught. Now, when you look, though, at what's going to be accomplished there, those three things in particular, it's hard not to see the work of Jesus here. Start at Hebrews 9, verse 26. Hebrews chapter 9, and verse 26. Go and read that. Please.
verse 24. So again, it's hard to imagine this referring to anything other than the work of Jesus. But then it also says to bring in everlasting righteousness. What's interesting to me about that is the first part talks about what he's going to take away. He doesn't just take away. He brings in. He takes away sin. He brings in righteousness. Romans 1 and verse 17. For in it, referring back to the gospel, he talked about it in the previous verse. The gospel is the power of God to salvation. The righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith. That is, it's written. The just shall live by faith. It's hard to imagine this righteousness describing any other righteousness than what is described here in Romans 1 and verse 17. And by the way, Revelation 14 and verse 6 does describe the gospel. Righteousness, of course, that is contained within it. Then it says, seal up vision and prophecy. Did Jesus do that? He seal up vision and prophecy. And then that'll happen. Acts 3 and verse 24. About the mention of Samuel there. It says, all the prophets from Samuel and those who follow, as many as have spoken, have also been told these days. So, see the idea there? At least what's presented in that passage. Everything the prophets prophesied of are now being fulfilled. Okay. Now, this is the age they were speaking of. Right. So we don't have another age to come where, you know, these prophecies will now be fulfilled. They're being fulfilled now. And I would suggest that 1 Peter 1, verses 10 through 12, says the same thing. It talks about angels desiring to look into these things that these prophets have prophesied about. And it speaks of the things that are now being revealed in the gospel. And so, I think that's the idea behind sealing up vision and prophecy. It is all now being fulfilled in this age and in what Christ is accomplishing through the gospel. Then also says to anoint the most holy. The literally holy of holies are the holiest. Hard not to see a connection to what is said about the Messiah in the following verses, especially since the word Messiah means the anointed. Really, the anointing of the Messiah is certainly a very prominent theme in prophecy. We're not going to take the time to read all of these, but these are just kind of representative of many passages that speak of that. All right, so that's kind of an overview. That's sort of some things that are going to take place in general church and what would happen during the 70 weeks. But then we see the 70 weeks broken down into three segments. Now let's make sure we see the beginning point and the ending point. Before we go any further, we've got to see the beginning and we've got to see the end. The beginning point is the command to restore and reveal Jerusalem. Right? What's the ending point?
Christ coming.
Christ coming, but more than that. What's the end?
Jerusalem.
The destruction of Jerusalem. That's the end of it. Desolation upon Jerusalem and the temple. So the 70 weeks takes us all the way through that. Starts with the command to restore and rebuild. It ends with the desolation that comes upon. Alright, so the 70 weeks are broken down into three segments. What are they? How's it divided down? We've got the first 7 weeks. Then what? 62 weeks. How many left? Alright, you got 1 week. Alright, what takes place during the 7 weeks? Is it not the restoration, the rebuilding of Jerusalem, even in troublesome times? What does that refer to that it was rebuilt during troublesome times?
Yeah,
remember Sanballat and
course, they also had a lot of problems from within. You know, there was outside opposition, but there was also some internal strife. Right, so you have the restoration, the rebuilding of Jerusalem, okay, within the first 7 weeks. And then in the 62 weeks, we don't really have a lot of detail. But these verses do bring us to who? Until the what? Until the Messiah. These verses do bring us to the Messiah, the Prince. Until Messiah the Prince is the way that it's worded in verse 25. Alright, so then the last week, we'll just say right now that it's very difficult. We're going to kind of break that down a little bit more. So let's look at that last week. First of all, the Messiah shall be cut off. That plainly says that this is after the 69 weeks. Now, I want to emphasize that because if you'll look up sometime a premillennial version of the 70 weeks, you'll see that they include the cutting off of the Messiah within the 62 weeks. They have it within the 62 weeks. That contradicts the text here that says it's after those 62 weeks. Okay. Now, the reason they do that is, right, they've got the cutting off within the 69 weeks, but that final week, they've got to have a whole bunch of events to take place. They've got to have the appearance of what they would refer to as the Antichrist. They've got the rapture coming in. They've got all kinds of events, you know, all of that. But again, one of the basic errors is not understanding that this is after the 69 weeks. Isaiah 53 and verse 8 says, "For he was cut off from the land of the living." That was prophesied concerning him, and I believe there's certainly a connection between the two there. And then in the latter part of verse 26, "And the people of the prince who is to come will destroy the city and the sanctuary, and its end will come with a flood. Even to the end, there will be war. Desolations are determined." Now, it's hard for me not to see this as that same destruction that Jesus prophesied about concerning the destruction of Jerusalem, that one that we talked about just a little bit earlier. Because, remember now, we're down to the final week. The Messiah is cut off. So we have something that's going to happen pretty soon after that, right? Well, it was within about 40 years that the destruction of Jerusalem came, just as Jesus said it would. "Then he shall confirm a covenant." New American Standard says, "Make a firm covenant with many for 1 week." Well, I'm not sure that I understand all of that precisely either. Could it be saying this or something along these lines? First of all, I can't think of any covenant that it would refer to other than the new covenant. I believe that's in view. Now, exactly what is meant by making it in, for 1 week and all that. Okay. The new covenant already established by Christ would be further strengthened. Its permanence clearly demonstrated when all the debris from the old covenant was swept away. Now, when was the new covenant established? Upon the death of Christ. Let's make sure we understand that. Alright, but the Jews who rejected him continued to do what? They continued to observe the old law, and they continued to observe the sacrifices, they continued to do everything in the temple, just like the law of Moses. There's a lot of trash. There's a lot of debris still hanging around from the old covenant. In other words, some people are not getting the message. Well, the message will be received. And that temple is there in ruins. Now, you say, well, sounds like a lot of just making up stuff to me. Well, you be the judge. Is this kind of what Hebrews 8 and verse 13 is indicating? Now, Hebrews is written, the new covenant's already been established. Let's make sure we understand that.
It says, in that he says a new covenant, he has made the first obsolete. Now, what is becoming obsolete and growing old is ready to vanish away.
Some are still continuing to cling to is going to be taken out of the way. It's going to be left desolate. So I believe that's at least part of what's conveyed here in that expression.
But in the middle of the week, he shall bring an end to sacrifice and offering. There in verse 27.
Well, how did that come?
Well, the sacrifice of Christ, we know this for a fact, rendered the Old Testament sacrifices null and void.
We can read Hebrews 10, 1 through 18, a whole bunch of other New Testament passages to confirm that.
But is that the meaning here?
It doesn't say to render them null and void, they're no longer necessary. It doesn't kind of use the same language in Hebrews 9, it says to make an end of them. I mean, they're going to cease. So it seems to be a little bit more emphatic. I think really what fits the context better is that the Jewish sacrificial system would be forever disrupted with Jerusalem. I think that's probably more the idea.
Josephus, in his book called Wars, he writes extensively about the destruction of Jerusalem by the Roman army. He reports that it was on the 17th day of Panemus or Tammuz, which was the fourth month corresponding to our June or July, that the sacrifice called the daily sacrifice had failed.
And it brings it down to the day when that temple is in ruins and there's no more the sacrifice. So Josephus seemed to have the idea that that's exactly when this took place.
But again, that's just trying to make the best of what is presented. And then on the wing of abominations will come one who makes desolate, even until a complete destruction, one that is decreed, is poured out on the one who makes desolate. Well, in Luke chapter 21, in one of those passages that Jesus talks about the destruction of Jerusalem, it says, but when you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that its desolation.
Now what's interesting is if you look at the parallel passage in Matthew 24, verse 15, it says, when you see the abomination of desolation in the holy place, then you'll know it's time to play. And so you put those together, it connects the abomination of desolation with what? With this Roman army. They have come to bring it down.
You see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then know that it's desolation. There's that word again.
Used so frequently here in chapter 9 and also in the vision itself.
Then let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let those who are in the midst of her depart. Well,
I hope we didn't go too fast, but I think the idea is pretty clear. At least the main idea of it. When Daniel prays, remember he's very concerned about the state of Jerusalem. He knows it's in desolation now, and he knows why it is. And so, when God brings in this vision, it most certainly has something to say about Jerusalem, about the temple, for which Daniel is so concerned. He said, okay, the time to come, it will be restored, and it will be end of this 70-week period, it is going to be brought to a full end. It's going to be consummated. The city and the temple are going to be destroyed. Again, all of that is in harmony with what Jesus said right there in the New Testament concerning this destruction that was to come. You see the similarity in language used there in Matthew 24 and the other passage to what is used here in Daniel chapter 9. So I think that's a big part of the vision anyway. Or at least maybe the main point that we need to get out of. One question about that covenant deal. It says he shall confirm the covenant for 1 week. I know you tell me what question comes to your mind when you see he'll confirm the covenant for 1 week. If indeed it's talking about the new covenant, what problem does that raise in your mind?
Here it does sound like it survives and follows the loose one.
Exactly. Yeah. So why would it say he shall confirm the covenant for 1 week? Think about the vision and what's recorded in the vision. Any ideas? What's the end of the vision? The end of the 7 weeks. He's talking about what's going to happen during that time frame. And so in keeping with the time frame of the vision, he talks about keeping this covenant for 1 week. In other words, all the language used within the vision is used with that time frame in mind. We don't look at that and say, well, somehow it must have ended. I mean, that would contradict clear passages which describe it as an everlasting covenant. So I think that's probably the explanation behind that. Okay, any other thoughts or questions? Go ahead, Al.
When you talk about the destruction of the temple and how Daniel does about the temple in Jerusalem, when I read the prayer of Daniel, I get the opinion that he's not talking about what God did, but what they did. That they're the ones that did all this. And he's more, to me, he's asking God to forgive him. Please, you know, we don't deserve it, but please do this.
And I like the phrase that Daniel uses a couple of times. Correct me if I'm wrong here, but something to the effect of, to you belongs righteousness.